as in basically all the performances, you did use all the ideas that are assigned to your body, like being gay, like having HIV. But at the same time, I think that they were, in a sense, reserved, that we are not shocked anymore. You know, like in 90s or 80s even, people would have felt appalled. And this is maybe how we perceive your performance in the 90s and nowadays. It varies a lot. And it has to do with sociopolitical questions as well, and how the idea of the body, of sickness, had changed. In a sense, we may feel that we are more acceptant towards HIV, but is it true?
Yeah, I don't know if acceptance is the right word, but it is a post-AIDS reality. So AIDS isn't the forefront issue. So you don't think of AIDS or HIV when you see blood. Maybe when you see a certain type of body, but that's not my kind of body, like a post-medication body, because I don't take medication. I think the images of this performance came from realizing that we are in a post-AIDS time, and then I, you know, personally have questions after this long trajectory of mid-80s, I have HIV and I'm going to die, to mid-90s, I have HIV and I'm going to die, to, oh, there's these medicines, nobody's dying anymore, really, and then what does that mean, kind of, image-wise, and you know, that's just one layer. You know, everything from sexual expression to my strange relationship between male and female within myself, and creating illusions with that.
The first thing I remembered, of course, with the wig and brushing the hair, was a reference to Marina Abramović. Though
it was a reference I put together afterwards. Actually, I didn't think of her piece, and then. And I thought, oh, the brushing, but of course the same inspiration. There's this, a beautiful woman brushes her hair 100 strokes, or, you know, there's some kind of old saying like that. This repetitive action is just this lead-in, because for me the wig isn't drag. It's not persona. It was constructed as a reveal, because I didn't want to show the piercings. Only the bleeding, so it's kind of a beauty construct in a way, but it's not a character. That's in my logic anyway. in reality, what you see is SAU's a bronzer on my skin. It's these ideas of California health that's resonated through the world, which is like a bronzed blonde is healthy, even if it's on an anorexic or on a post-AIDS body. It's still signifies kind of radiant health.
It was all about beauty, but then again, if we say the body in the 90s, in a body art performance, or life art as some might call it, was shocking and appalling and grievated and so on and so forth. And now this body presents itself as in a museum setting, in a cubus, a glass cubus that was basically as a museum piece. Is that reference to the state of body art that has gained somewhat some acknowledgement in society after 90s?
No. I am not aware of that at all. It's actually a way of playing with the idea that that the signifiers don't signify what they signify. So I think by displaying it as an object kind of turns it inside out. Like, what's really on display? Is it really a 50-year-old man? Or is it, you know, some kind of nude drag body? Like, how can a male body be in drag nude? And how is the body super sexy and healthy, or is the body sick, masquerading as curvaceous and blonde? So it's kind of a play with myself, because I think those kind of images are internal, these contrasts. But in terms of an awareness of where are me and body art sitting in the 2011, I don't think I That's such a question, because I don't like those categories necessarily. I acknowledge them. You know, it is body art as such, and I certainly come from a period of, you know, what was called abject art in the 90s. Yet I think there was always a sort of poeticness to it that wasn't just rude or in a more punk rock spirit, like fuck you, this is what it is. But possibly because of the political issues of the 80s and 90s, the intention was more didactic then. Like it had the polemic was a little bit clearer. And I think just in general, the polemic isn't clear right now in my life and many post conditions going on.
You work with Kira O'Reilly on her university.
Queen Mary?
Queen Mary's university.
We've been in the same seasons here, yes. I don't find the university the authoritative. It's a bubble for the people that are there. Mm-hmm. Does it influence other people? Not so much. It resonates out if people who are going there take it out somewhere. But it's actually an important but compartmentalized part. I think what it can do, and I would think more of, say, this documentary Hallelujah that was made in 99, 2000, or finished at that time, of the company work I did, which was very martyrology of AIDS. To me, sometimes when something official is made, it also ends needing to express it anymore. So already that kind of prompted me to move to solo work at that time. Not be so issue-oriented, because I felt like, okay, this was done, recorded, interpreted through a filmmaker's agenda. Really, you know, let's say it was 70%. I would agree with the agenda, but it still wasn't my project. And academia is like that. People teach you things, but it's still their interpretation of what this work or this movement, you know, this what really did the 90s body art movement mean? Like, is there so many parallels between me and Franco B and Kira O'Reilly? Or was it just this kind of common, we're working with the body so we can link them all together? Because I think the body is a very personal experience in a way, and there's also different lenses, which at that time, you know, they've melted down some, but they were geographic. Like, I do think of coming from Los Angeles, I have a twisted view of the body. Like, it's never good enough. It's never, everything that's in front of you is too product-oriented. Everything, you know, that's probably where Photoshop was invented. Certainly touch-ups, you know. So you're comparing your body against a cartoon of a body. I see that with musculature of muscle people. They look at photographs of people with muscles who happen to be dehydrated and lit just right. So they are trying to attain this body that doesn't even exist on this person who's actually a midget with muscles. So it's this illusion that keeps spinning in a way. So I think that this being like an LA body, and then in some places having a more cerebral culture, we're less body oriented, but somehow all of that has been mixing and spinning together since the 90s until now. So I'm not saying everywhere is the same, but maybe the specifics and what are the influences now that influences are more global.
These are two aspects of how one may enter interpreting yesterday's piece. One is this very historical of how we view the body and how we have learned to experience such performance where there is a certain experience that one cannot rationalize. And one entry point is this historical view, and another one is very autopoetic. In a sense, I would say you put your body in display, you multiply it, but then you secure it from people entering it. You know, it's not, if I were to look to some of the work from the 90s, that they were more directly tactile, and this was very reserved, and the public was not entering a direct contact. Mm-hmm. How do you see this change?
I assume all the work that I've done informs this work. So I don't think this work, like I've burned all my previous work. And what I've put out about myself is suddenly here's a new piece. That's why I was so... Whether or not it's some articulate statement about the post-AIDS body, the reality is in my life it's the post-AIDS body. So coming from this point of view of displaying myself over and over again as a living corpse in work in different ways, I thought about the living part of the corpse, like how to energize it in a stylized way. So I think maybe workings of this piece actually, I think I was trying to attain ecstasis behind the glass. Now I'm actually not trying to do that, and the actions don't directly symbolize anything. The sequence of experiencing the actions does, I don't know, for the viewer possibly, but it's still experiential, even if there's not a way for you inside immediately.
That's actually very parallel to what has happened to other parts of art. If you look at general fine art, it was very straightforward political, or talking about socio-political contexts, and now it does have a tendency to be more poetic and more formal. But what I was wondering about a piece that I am not very well familiar actually with Julian Snapper, or Judas Cradle. Could you tell us a little bit?
Well, that's, you know, quite different because it was a collaboration. Like, my commitment to it was something that was out of my realm, singing. I'm not a singer, I'm not a songbird, I don't sing in private, I don't sing in public. I'm not a songbird. And, you know, she comes from a long line of opera singers, so she was probably singing opera before she was speaking. Like, you know, learn how to speak bel canto. So to actually, you know, spend 2 years with her training and developing this piece and watching opera and watching how classical operas were restaged, say, especially in Eastern European countries, so power dynamics were changed. So the queen was staged on a lower platform and the peasant with the babushka was bigger and railing, you know, some of those songs were louder. Just these ideas of how to change something without getting in copyright trouble or something opened up this avenue of using existing quotations from, you know, how corny to use Puccini, but to take Turandot and make like a ghosting duet from it. So it was really a whole new expression for me that was over my head or out of my realm of understanding at first. The themes were torture. The kind of inspiring part, I don't know why I got obsessed with the Judas Cradle, but I was reading something where it was invented as a kinder, gentler form of torture. So from the era where people were put on the rack, suddenly this thing called, in Italian, the watch, which was just used for sleep deprivation. Like every time you started to fall asleep, they'd lower you and just hit you on it, which of course perverted into hanging sandbags from your legs and you know, actually impaling you and splitting you open. So this progression of, you know, I guess this idea that torture is torture. Once you open the door, it keeps going. And kind of in that immediate climate, these first photos were released from Abu Ghraib of these, you know, the sort of humiliation and sexual abuse tortures of prisoners and the using attack dogs on them and even the photos they didn't release of using these certain types of light fixtures they were anally inserting into the prisoners, which they didn't release. But it became this strange line between human rights atrocities and pornography that no one could say the pornography part of it, but it was so clear and that even, you know, one of the main people involved, I think her name was Lindsay England, she looks like a dyke, and then she became pregnant during this time because she was so, you know, they were so wound up between torturing the prisoners and the guards were fucking each other, you know, on their downtime, wound up from, I don't know, it was an amazing public perversion.